Okay, hi everybody, and this is Michael, and this is a. I had in mind to do a compilation. I've done compilations on the first, second, and third initiations, and now this is the fourth initiation, of course. Out of our grasp. So demanding that it really represents the liberation of the individual into the range of the monad. I think we're lucky if we can think in terms of the third degree. And not everybody in DK's group, as a matter of fact, really only a minority, took the second degree. So we're thinking ahead, but so often people do confuse the second initiation with the fourth initiation. They have a tough time in life and it's emotionally stressing. And they think they are passing through the fourth initiation. If you read the material on ISGL, I know that the word stability was there and also group love and I'm not sure about the I, but we can find out what that is. I've repeated that in other broadcasts. Well, he certainly thought he was passing through the fourth degree. And I think to have DK tell him that if he worked hard, he might pass through the second was just too humiliating for him as a personality, and he quit. We do have to be ready for the group gaze, that the group will see who and what we are. And that is difficult. I hope you can, I hope you can see me. And if I turn this off, it looks like it's the same. So, this is the picture. Well, you don't see it, but this is the picture of what I know you should be seeing. So, excuse my occasional coughs. The initiate stays in the master's group until he has taken the fourth initiation. Well, let us think about the six stages of discipleship. To be an accepted disciple means pretty much that you have taken the first degree and are close to taking the second. To be in the fourth stage, the chela. Chela on the thread. I think I may have made a mistake there in the other work. It's the fifth stage that is the stage of chela in the aura, but chela on the thread means you are really approaching the third degree. Then chela in the aura means you're there. And chela within the master's heart can take you all the way to the fourth initiation. Thereafter follows something that brings you to the fifth initiation called the blending of the lights. Not much is said about it, but it makes of a man a master. Well, rather than go back and try to correct that, I'm just going to assume that you are moving ahead and that you will realize that Shela in the aura is the fifth stage and not the fourth, as I may have said yesterday. Trying to find all that is just not worth it. So it's pretty much the sixth stage of discipleship, which takes us into a Buddhic state of awareness and is the chela in the master's heart. I always hate to make mistakes like that, but sometimes you just have to pass it by, and I hope that it has not been too misleading. Let's see here. Okay. Okay. Now let's go a little further. And what I'll try to do is bring in something of a purple nature, if I have to use it again, and that will be it. So from discipleship, page 728, disciples who have taken the second initiation are regarded as probationary initiates. A true, a true probationer in the strictly discipleship sense is one who has not even taken the, or entered the stage of accepted disciple. But here we most likely are the accepted disciple, and we're on, we're being tested for real initiation, which is the initiation at the third degree. That's the true initiate. So disciples who have taken the second initiation are regarded as probationary initiates, and only when they have taken the third initiation, as Master Jesus did, the now Master Jesus, when he was Joshua the high priest, only when they have taken the third initiation are they truly initiate, from the standpoint of the hierarchy and not simply a probationary initiate. The first initiation is sometimes called the, spoken of as the Lemurian initiation. Well, it certainly involves the planet Venus on a lower turn of the spiral. And it involves the fifth ray. And it's the beginning of real self-consciousness reflective of the Lemurian individualization. And the second initiation is known as the Atlantean initiation. It does involve the astral body and its relationship to the heart, just the way this Lemurian initiation, although all of them operate in relation to the heart center, the Lemurian initiation deals with the sacral center and its rising to the throat. Also, at the second initiation, we do have a very strong throat center stimulation, and we noted that a lot of intelligence came into the Atlantean race among the higher brackets of that race. And so it wasn't only solar plexus and heart, it was the intelligence and the creativity of the throat center. But the third initiation, that of our Aryan race, specifically associated with this third of the self-conscious races, the Aryan is really the fifth race if we count the Adamic and Hyperborean races, both of which periods took a long time. This third initiation is technically regarded by them, the masters, as the first initiation. It's the first solar initiation. The other two are before it are planetary initiations and can be considered of the threshold. This is, he says here, a new angle upon which I would ask you to think. The term, therefore, of accepted disciple covers the stages of first and second initiation. Most of the accepted disciples who were in DK's groups were simply initiates of the first degree. The majority had not even yet reached the second degree, so that does put things in proportion, doesn't it? The term, therefore, of accepted disciple covers the first and second initiations. When a disciple has taken the third initiation, he is no longer technically an accepted disciple, even though he's still, this is something that Zach enlarged here, because it's important, even though he still remains in the master's group until he has taken the fourth initiation. And once he has taken that, I suppose he can even be the head of his own ashram, especially if the ashram is of the material or scientific type on the higher levels of the mental plane and not so much on the Buddhic plane. So, and as I said before, trying to correct my mistake there, that we're dealing with the transition from the chela in the aura, the fifth stage of discipleship, to the chela within the master's heart, number six, which is not a sentimental relationship. It has to do with ashramic intimacy. I'm pointing out these technicalities so that there may be clarity and proportion in your thinking. And you know, some of our students are really fond of the technicalities, and they are important so as to be able to identify that through which fellow disciples are passing. But of course, it's the experience that is the of major import. Now, we're still pretty much going on here in this six stages of discipleship section. So we're on page 761, and it's pretty much, I think, the first volume. I would like, however, to make clear at this point that the master never uses a disciple's centers as distributing agencies for force. Well, Moria says something maybe a little different, that in the battle, aspects of the warrior disciples' aura are torn loose and used in the battle. Can I say hurled at the enemy? In any case, the auric equipment of the individual disciple is useful to the warrior member of hierarchy who is using the disciple as an agent in the battle. But anyway, this is Master DK's perspective. And probably there is a difference between what Moria is describing and what DK is trying to describe here. The master never uses the disciples' centers as distributing agencies for force. In the last analysis, the centers are, when functioning correctly, reservoirs of force and distributors of energy, colored by specific quality and a certain note, vibration and strength. Well, you know, a planetary quality, a ray quality, and then a degree of vibratory strength, a lesser degree or a greater degree. Because the ray, a configuration of a center and its astrological association, does not tell you basically how strongly that center is vibrating or emanating or radiating. On the final stages of the path of discipleship, on which, of course, the individual is an initiate, they are entirely controlled by the soul via the head centers, I suppose, within the head or as part of the ajna group. You sometimes see those what look like feathered headdress, a feathered headdress. It's narrow and it, you know, almost looks like a mohawk cut. But various centers in a higher ajna group are found in that configuration. On the final stages of the path of discipleship, they are entirely controlled by the soul. I guess this is telling us that for most of us, these centers are not entirely controlled by the soul, not yet. Via the head center, that's the singular. And within that head center are the many chakras, of the head centers above the head. But it should be borne in mind that after the fourth initiation and the disappearance, however gradual, of the causal body, there is no form aspect or vehicle which can hold the disciple prisoner or anyway, limited. I guess when something explodes in space, it takes some time to clear the debris, and one gets the sense that the debris is being cleared between the fourth and fifth initiations. So that a great revelation, that's the name of the fifth initiation, can come at that fifth initiation. After the third initiation, the lower centers have no control whatsoever, and it'd be, I think, good for some of our ambitious disciples to realize that if they are somehow controlled by the sub-diaphragmatic centers, they really haven't taken a third initiation. But always there is exaggeration, you know how it goes. After the third initiation, the lower centers have no control whatsoever, although, you know, there is that base of the spine center, which is the most active at the fifth initiation, so we have to really wonder what control is. Certainly there's a great participation of that base of the spine center, just the way there would be in our solar system involving Pluto. As the ruler of the base of the spine center, not the only planet that's there. Mercury is there, Mars is there, even Saturn and Uranus have their associations. But there is something about the complete activation of the base of the spine center, which does, while beginning at the third degree, really climax at the fifth. So after the third initiation, the lower centers have no control whatsoever over the outer mechanism of response. That is, from the standpoint of the highest occult training. See, so right in there you have to read the hints. And when the disciple is in the ashram itself, the centers are viewed as simply channels for energy. Until, you know, it's so interesting that Pluto is a non-sacred planet, but still it's an esoteric planet, and its full activation is not really going to be put into expression until the fifth initiation. But really, the Earth, it's the Earth itself, which is the base of the spine center. So there's kind of a triangle between Earth, Pluto, Mars, and we have to remember that Mercury and Saturn and Uranus are also involved. There's something very synthetic about that fifth initiation of Revelation. And how they all fit together, well, that remains to be seen, but they all have a role to play. With Mars being a Kundalini latent, or in, you know, relatively inactive, and Mercury being Kundalini active. Okay, until the time of the third initiation, they assume temporary importance in the training process because it is through them that the disciple learns the nature of energy. Its distinction from force and the methods of distribution, the latter being one of the last stages in the training process. So as we're on our way up, we definitely work with the lower centers and their elevation and transmutation into the sphere of the higher centers. It's such a dividing line. In a way, you begin your real discipleship in relation to the star Sirius when the third initiation is taken. And, you know, it is a solar initiation, not just planetary. And the minute we have that solar initiation, we have the beginning of a relationship with the star Sirius. So many things are concealed in Master DK's material. And you have to really read between the lines, and you have to pull in the associations, which reaches a high point of achievement when we know something about pure reason and the Buddhic flame. And we don't know about that immediately. We know about reasoning. We learn how to think and think towards a solution, but an intuitively apprehended solution which is truthful is not what occurs for us immediately once we begin to navigate the Buddhic plane. More and more we are capable of doing that. Understanding straight knowledge and the immediacy of truth. So sometimes DK encourages the use of the centers as distributing agents, and other times he said, well, just be transparent and let the soul work through you, and don't engage the directive mind too much in aiming the energies of the particular chakras. So it takes a long time to really work so that one is effective. And so often in the beginning, students are eager to manipulate forces of the personality via the personality centers. In the beginning, I think sometimes we just have to open ourselves to the soul and to use the energy of goodwill and the will to good in the direction of the individual or group that we would help. So as always, patience is going to be required, lest we really create a situation which is obstructive, really. The next one, you know, we're all in the same area here. Page 767, so we're still in the six or even seven stages of discipleship. For another thing, brother of mine, when the disciple reaches this stage, he is no longer what you understand by an accepted disciple. His, we might say, his relationship to the master is even more intimate. He is an initiate of high standing and of elevated degree, and has passed out of the supervision and the safeguarding of a master. So I guess the initiate, well, it's hard to believe that the initiate is not somehow safeguarded in some higher sense by the master, but not so much attention needs to be given to him because he's much less prone to make the kind of mistakes made early in his discipleship career. So he doesn't need perhaps that immediate supervision of a master. And he passes into a direct relation with the master of all the masters, the Christ. This seems to happen at the first solar initiation. The Christ being, of course, a great, as far as our humanity is concerned, a solar deity, and occupying the seventh rung of the ladder. He's taking the seventh initiation, and that seventh degree is ruled by the second ray and is closely related to the solar factor, the sun. So he passes into a direct relation with the Christ, which means he really is a more steady point within the ashram. The master is the heart of his group and also the head, we've been told elsewhere. And the Christ is the heart of the hierarchy, and we've been told also that he is the head of the hierarchy. The closer one gets to realization, I guess that could be said to really begin at the fifth degree, the clearer becomes the concept that the point at the center and the periphery are one. Can we think about that for a minute? Okay. So the centrality of the hierarchy is becoming available to the one who is penetrating the ashram. Now, none of DK's group, maybe Alice Bailey, were really doing that. I guess Alice Bailey is now the particular secretary to Master KH, and in a way occupies the outer office or ante chamber for those who would are seeking or have been evoked to experience an interview with the master, same as Foster Bailey doing in Master M's ashram. So, okay, the master is the heart of his group, and the Christ is the heart of the hierarchy. And the center and the periphery are one, which has to be pondered. But certainly in a condition of unity, we begin to realize that that is possible. And the distinctions brought about by our usual perception of space or time and space are no longer holding. they no longer have the same significance or sense of reality about them as we may have thought. And the significance of the word heart is the significance of life itself. I think about that heart and life, and how the life thread or sutratma is anchored in the heart, as it beats eternally at the very heart of the universe, a great universal heart, and certainly a heart which operates in relation to smaller structures. Within that life, the initiate consciously stands, realizing himself not so much as being a recipient of life, but as a distributor of life, a great animation, a great livingness, a great connection with being. Already he has touched the life and can direct it towards those who are more in need of coming in touch with its reality. So he says, this is a very different thing, and holds the key to this stage of discipleship. I guess this is the number six, the disciple within the master's heart. The master's heart is a technical term indicating the sources of life, and many analogous interpretations. It touches that which truly lives, that ongoing eternal energy. It has no sentimental connotation. There is, at this stage and after a certain major initiation, a direct line of energy or of life, sensed, recognized, active, and utilized between the conscious disciple and what? And number one, the disciple's heart center, you know, at the center of which is the seat of life or being, and the heart center in the head. There are a number of different heart centers. Even the egoic lotus is a kind of a heart center, and there are heart centers within the spiritual triad, and the monad itself is a kind of heart center. The egoic lotus also, there's a link, a direct line of energy or of life reaching the egoic lotus, which until the fourth initiation is the heart center of the monadic life. But of course, as I say, in a way, the rays of the monad are first and second, generically. And the monad is a kind of heart center. And I wouldn't be surprised if etheric heart centers of the solar logos, maybe the planetary logos, are found on the monadic plane. Just the way etheric head centers would be found on the logoic plane. Many things to put together, aren't there? Also, a connection between the master and the at the center of his group, who is, in a way, I suppose, considered the heart of the ashram, but also elsewhere it tells us the monadic head of the ashram. Also a connection with the Christ, the heart center of the hierarchy, and in a way he directs the ashram as the head of the hierarchy, as which he is referred. And then the life of the monad, which begins to make itself felt at the third initiation, even though the line direct is not really absorbed until the fourth initiation. This monad is a Jupiterian structure, Jupiter hierarchically ruling Virgo and Jupiter exoterically ruling Pisces. And there's a very powerful second ray with Jupiter. But also you begin to wonder whether deeply recessed within it is not some first ray. So there's the direct connection here when we get into this stage with the monad, eventually. And finally, the Lord of Life himself, the heart center of Shambhala, isn't that interesting? Maybe, is he the head of Shambhala? Well, he's certainly an extension of the planetary logos, an emanation. And he has the highest expression of the teaching ray to his credit. He's also called the Great Sacrifice. He's called by many names. Sanat Kumara is. And it's said that he is a blend of the soul and the personality. It says he's many things, and exactly what he is, I think he's going to have to wait for deeper experience on our part. But in any case, these are technical terms of understanding, indicating sources of life and many analogous interpretations. And there is at this stage, and after a certain major initiation, could it be the fourth, a direct line of energy or of life, sensed, recognized, active, and utilized between the conscious disciple, who by this time is a high initiate, and different aspects of the equipment. And is this after the causal body, egoic lotus, is destroyed? Because, you know, when you have a Maya Varupa, it pretty much replicates, only on a much higher turn of the spiral, the chakric equipment of the individual. So we're dealing with hearts and we're dealing with heads. So interesting that there are considered to be three hearts, one within the torso, between the shoulder blades, one at the top of the head. Well, you might look for the egoic lotus as being a kind of heart, but a higher 12 is found on the monadic plane. Is the monad 12-fold? Well, one of the major planets ruling it in signs is the 12th. The 12th sign Pisces. And so there's a higher 12 there. 12 is a consummatory number. So we're making our way from hierarchy to Shambhala. And numbers 2 and 1 are involved. The line of relationship then extends from these onward and onward and upward. Spherically considered, it sounds Jupiterian, doesn't it? Like the expansion of the sphere. To the life at the very center of our Earth's alter ego, the planet Venus. Venus is, I think, a kind of a solar plexus center, but it has, we learned from cosmic fire, a very strong connection with the heart. Its monadic ray is the sixth, the same number that defines the plane on which the monad is found, and the second ray, probably the ultimate ray, on the Lagoic plane, etherically expressed, the ultimate ray for Venus. So it extends into the alter ego, the planet Venus, and then to Jupiter, which has a second ray soul, whatever its monadic ray may be, whether the seventh or the first, and thence to the solar lord himself, Helios, soul, our solar logos, and on to a point in the sun, Sirius. So this is a very strong alignment. Sirius may have a fifth ray soul, but again, like Venus, there's every reason to think that the monadic expression of Sirius is both the sixth and eventually the second, just the way it is for Venus, who is kind of, you might say, a lesser Sirius. Every planet in our solar system has a special connection with one of the seven solar systems, of which ours is one. Jupiter connects with our sun, and our planet Venus, I believe, shows us the Sirian connection, and then there would be others connected with those seven major planets. And seven suns. You can see, therefore, how different this stage is, the stage of Chela within the Master's heart from what might be imagined. It is one which marks a new departure or beginning and a great transition. Well, that transition is really into the cosmic ethers, isn't it? Which cosmically considered is an area of expression which is principled, whereas the lower 18 subplanes, and maybe from the solar perspective, the lower 21 subplanes of our cosmic physical plane are not cosmically principled. It is a stage which one enters through the open door of nirvana. Now, interestingly, the nirvanic plane is sometimes associated with Atma. I guess there are different levels of nirvana, but the atmic plane is called the nirvanic plane and gives us entree into the monadic level. So this stage, which involves the monad, obviously, in some way, it's the beginning of the path of higher evolution. In a way, that path begins on the monadic plane, because it is, after all, the monad. It's a hard thing to think about, which travels in its awareness to distant places or levels of vibration. It is a stage, you know, the Chela within the Master's heart, which marks a specific location, if such an inappropriate word can be used. It's not really a location, it's a vibratory intensity, right? But anyway, a specific location of the disciple upon the upward way, which is revealed by the lighted way. That path, the path of the lighted way, reveals the way of higher evolution. It is the attainment of the innermost point of realization, called esoterically within the heart, and it is related, I think, to something quite irreducible, which we call being, the very heart of life, the very heart of the monad, the very center of that from which all things come. There's a lot of depth here, isn't there? And I'm certainly not saying that I'm capturing it all or suggesting it all. But something is being suggested. Number 103, I'd like to arrest any tendency. Yeah, I can see we're not going to, certainly not going to finish this section. Okay, I would like to arrest any tendency to consider one ashram as superior to another. They're all absolutely needed, and just like every ray of light within the spectrum is needed as you break down white lights. So no ashram, whether in incarnation or not, is superior to another. The 49 ashrams, which constitute the hierarchy, so all the seven per ray, these subsidiaries, 49 ashrams which constitute the hierarchy in this planetary period, so maybe there will not be 49 later, maybe they will reduce to 21 and 7 and 3 and so forth. Are some of them fully active? Some are in process of formation. And some are, as yet, in a totally embryonic condition. We're not there yet in terms of having evolved or formulated all the subsidiary ashrams. And they're awaiting the, quote, focusing ability of some initiate, probably some master, yes, who is today preparing for the fifth initiation. So it takes a master to bring one of these subsidiary ashrams into full or fuller functioning activity. There's a lot of activity going on in the second ray ashram, and maybe only one of them, maybe two sub four, is not quite equal in development to the others. When it comes to the first ray ashram, is there any subsidiary? Or if there is, maybe only one. And different numbers are given to some of the different ashrams. You might have four developed or three developed. looking toward the ability of some initiate who will be able to take them over at the fifth degree. Essentially and potentially, all the ashrams are equal, and their quality is not competitive. Well, you know, there's such a tendency to have the spirit of competition or one-upsmanship, you know, in so much of what humanity does. It's not the way things are. Not at all. All of them differ as to their planned activity. They are a group, an interdisciplinary group that supplement each other. And we're just getting an idea of how that supplementation is working. I think, you know, we're in the middle now of a pandemic that, a universal epidemic that was maybe promised or withheld. And we're going to begin to see how the different groups assist each other. So all of them differ as to their planned activity, an activity which is all part of a carefully formulated hierarchical activity. We don't know about this, but there is a detailed plan regarding interdependency and mutual assistance. This you most carefully need most carefully to remember. The devotion of a disciple to some particular master is of no importance to that master or to his ashramic group. Quite a saying there, really, you know, because so many of us, having been raised through the power of devotion, think, okay, we're devoted to the master. This is a big, big thing. All of them, it is not devotion or predilection or any personality choice which governs the formation of a master's group. It is ancient relationship, the ability to demonstrate certain aspects of life to demanding humanity, so there's a skill involved, and the definite ray expression of quality which determines the hierarchical placement of the aspirants in an ashram. And notice that even though really in an ashram is the place for an initiate, he still calls them aspirants. Well, everybody and everything is an aspirant. Even our planetary logos is an aspirant to some higher stage. This will perhaps be a new thought to you and is responsible for the quote, underlined anyway, reason why AAB has never emphasized concentrating on some one of the known masters. All of them important, and now with the interdependency, a higher expression of the new group of world servers, that interdependency existing, there's a lot of borrowing going back and forth. I noted how a very important person with regard to the externalization of Master Maurya's ashram considered himself a second ray disciple on the soul ray and how it is that a couple of first-grade disciples like Foster Bailey and Mary Bailey found their way into leadership positions in the second ray group that Alice Bailey started. So Alice Bailey, she's always been aware that each central ashram has associated with it six other ashrams, which are steadily and constantly being organized to meet planetary need. Maybe not fully organized just yet. You will note I did not say human need, but the needs of the planet which the hierarchy has to meet embrace more than those of the fourth kingdom of nature, and I'd have you ponder on this point. All right, these are such excellent. So this is the end. Oh, goodness. End of fourth initiation commentary. Let's call it it's first initiation. I want the word fourth. And basically, we've gone from page 2 to page 4. Not a lot of progress in the sense of covering a lot of words, but the next time will be beginning of fourth initiation compilation commentary. And program 3. And this is program 2. Okay. Well, thank you, everybody. That's about an hour. I wish I could be precise in it, you know, but maybe I'm not so precise. And this will have to do for us. Commentary. What do you do when your keyboard begins to give out? Okay. That's it. So we will continue when it is possible. The conference is coming up, so certainly won't be possible to finish all this before the conference, but I want to get you going on it for a little bit, thinking about it. It's a reach to think of the fourth initiation, but nevertheless, we have to think about it. So lots of love, many blessings, and we will go on when we can do so. And that's going to be it. Bye-bye.